Hi, I'm Jenny Castro, and this is Holding It Together, a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Office of Women in Leadership and the Mennonite Inc.
When I talk about hard things like adultery and betrayal, I feel it actually lessens the weight of those words and their power over me.
Today on Holding It Together, we continue to break silences. Claire DeBerg will read her essay, Choosing Love, Adultery, Adoption, Abundance. Her essay was originally presented at the 2014 Women Doing Theology Conference, and it was included in the collection of essays based on that conference's theme, All You Need Is Love. Claire DeBerg is a mother, writer, wife, model, and Mennonite. She owns the writing agency Cicada, where she manages an all-woman crew of talented writers. She lives in the heart of Minnesota with her husband and two children. Visit the Holding It Together website on Fireside for Claire's full bio. I originally invited Claire to take part in the Breaking Silences series because of her courage to name and tell her whole story, mistakes, messiness, and all. My working title for the episode had been Infidelity, but after our conversation, that title no longer rang true. It felt shallow somehow. So I changed it to Wholeness.
These stories are about love. More specifically, they are about choosing love because, after all, love is a choice. Love doesn't just show up and solve problems. Love doesn't just appear and fix. Love must be invited. Love is available and powerful. And here's how love created abundance in my life once I chose it. I captured the neighborhood nickname Beauty and the Beast all in one for fierceness on all levels of my being. Deep down, I knew this about myself. I knew I had power, so I didn't wield it. I didn't drink like all my friends in high school. I didn't smoke the weed when it was passed to me in the circle. I didn't have sex before marriage or lie to my parents or swear like everyone around me was doing. I played life pretty guarded. Then I went to Bethel University at 18, got engaged to John at 19, and was married at 20. Whoa. I was given a full scholarship to the University of Alaska Anchorage in an MFA program, and our relationship looked like this. We were best friends. We laughed, we prayed, we loved grocery shopping. We read each other poetry. What we didn't have much of was intimacy. But I thought nothing of it because we were married. This just must be what marriage was like. I didn't choose to make our sex life a priority, but there was a surging inside me to be wanted. All of that swirling inside me was that fierceness like a hurricane in the middle of the ocean until that monster storm touched land and lives, and here's what happened. A man in my MFA program in Alaska pursued me with a feverish impatience. It felt wonderful to be wanted. This was nothing like what John and I had. This was sick infatuation. So I did the unthinkable. I had sex with a man other than my husband. I committed adultery. I cheated, I lied, I deceived, I pretended, I caved, I shrank, I broke promises, I hurt, I wounded, I misunderstood. I was an adulteress. My story is not a new story. I am not the first adulteress. I am not chronically unique in this regard, though I'd like to think I am. I can count the number of sexual encounters I had with him on one hand, and here's what happened next. One bright Alaskan morning, a moose stood at our back door, pawing it, trying to get inside. Somehow its huge, gentle eyes and velvety nose pushed me to do what I'd longed to do the moment I turned away from my marriage. I told John the truth. I was having an affair. Oh, the relief to let go of the darkness I clutched. I knew in that instant I wanted to be with John, not this other man with his hot, smoky demands breathed into my face or the ripped out hair and forced sex. That man was violent and scary. I wanted to be wanted by John. I got this rare opportunity to choose my husband once again, to choose love over fear. We called our parents and we cried and I apologized and I agonized and I was embarrassed. John and I committed to putting a gentle salve on this gaping wound in our marriage so we could heal together and perhaps, like a broken bone, repair to the point of being stronger than before. Then those high, loving conversations turned practical. John suggested I get tested for sexually transmitted diseases. I drove alone to the campus medical clinic and got tested for all of it, chlamydia, herpes, HIV, everything. The wait for results from the swabs and blood tests was short. The news from the doctor, I was clean. The other man's poison was emotional and physical, but not physiological. I gave a relieved thank you and prepared to leave. The doctor, while ticking off boxes on the form, said, "No STDs, but you are pregnant." And then there was stillness and a clanging silence that hurt my neck from straining to grasp the tone. The next moment, I'm in a triage counselor's office, her dimmed lights like a womb. It was murky and dark in Alaska nearly all day long at that point in winter. Like that heavy blackness, I could not see much light in my future at that point. What were my choices? The counselor told me, "Well, you can keep the baby, abort it, or place it for adoption." Keep it. Keep this child who was created in the middle of my greatest lie? No way. I wanted to work through my marriage with John. Abort it? No way. Adoption? The obvious yes. I could carry a life and give it to someone who really wanted it because I was sure John wouldn't want to raise a baby that wasn't his. I left that office and walked the empty halls of the campus. All the students had scattered for winter break. I cheated. I'm pregnant. I'm 22. All of these truths were the eye of the storm splitting apart my landscape when I saw my professor tripping down the hallway. In all my girlhood daydreaming about announcing my first pregnancy, I never imagined this scene. He was holding a mess of papers in his arms like he was looking for a garbage can to dispose of them. He was rambling, he spilled coffee on his shirt, and his scarf trailed behind him. But who was more hopeless, me or him? When he finally looked up and saw me, he said, "You're not okay. What happened?" So I told him, and he heaved his pile of papers onto the floor of his office, put on his parka, and said, "We're going to Sam's Club." For the first time in my life, I really wanted to go to Sam's Club right then. He bought a single thing, a very expensive calling card. It had something like 12 hours of time on it. He handed it to me and said, "You'll be making a lot of long distance calls this week. You're going to need this." At the time, it was the single best thing anyone did for me. Just something practical and normal and needed. He wasn't a counselor or a therapist or a nurse or even married himself, but he was right. I needed that calling card because I was on the phone a lot that week. In that moment, my professor chose to just love this messed up student of his with a simple gift. It was a window into what it would have been like if I had just chosen to love my husband when I was first pursued by another man. I drove home with my calling card, walked inside my little apartment, saw John and said, "There is news. I don't have anything, but I am pregnant." He hugged me. I must have said, "I'm so sorry," 50 times while we cried over broken dreams. Finally said, "We're going to Walgreens." I took my second trip to a store that day and John bought me prenatal vitamins. So even in the darkest hour of our relationship, he honored our vows and cared for me, the one who did all the hurting. John chose love instead of anger. We called our parents again with more incredible news, and we left Alaska. Eventually, John decided he could not stay married to me, and really, could I blame him? I'd cheated and gotten pregnant with another man. Reconciling those actions in a marriage would have been a mighty feat. John could not see his way through to doing that, and I understood. So we took our divorce papers to a notary public who sat down with us and said, "What can I notarize for you today? Let me guess, marriage papers." And we said, "No, we're actually getting a divorce." And her eyes widened as she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You just seem so happy, so nice to each other." Her response to our way of being gave us confidence in our decision to create the very best divorce we could. If people were going to talk about us, and they would, and they have, and they still do, we wanted our divorce to make people pay attention, take note, choose love. Even though I still believe divorce is so sad, mine is the best one I've ever heard about because we chose the way we were going to be was love. We're still choosing it because John and I live 10 blocks from one another to this day, and we're still actual friends. Once the divorce was final, I lived in the basement of a Mennonite church where my sister was the pastor. It had a little apartment where I could live in exchange for maintenance and anything else Jennifer could find for me to do until I figured out who would adopt my baby. The piles of profiles of potential adoptive families loomed on my desk. I'd grab a profile off the top, sink onto the couch, and let it rest on my stomach while I paged through the six or so scrapbook pages, laying out all the ways in which they would be a perfect couple to raise my baby. What a strange exercise, looking into snapshots of nice couples and all the things they liked to do. Flash, a couple riding bikes. Flash, a couple reading to their nephews. Flash, a couple baking Christmas cookies. All of these profiles started to swim before my eyes, their similarity being the lack of children in their homes. None of them called to me. None of the statements drew me in, made me certain I'd found the parents for my baby. I remember heaving up from a table where I just finished lunch with my friend June. I was telling her about being this parent consumer and how it felt horrible to eliminate people for the most ridiculous reasons when all they wanted was what I very much did not want, a baby. But the obese couple, no way. I could never send my baby into that family. The couple with a scrapbook portfolio littered with grammatical errors, totally out. How judgmental could I be? I mean, look what I'd done. But I'll never forget what June said in response. Well, Claire, no mother is going to be exactly like you and have all your qualities. You won't find her unless you're looking for yourself. I sat back down then and wasn't sure what to say next, when in reality, the bigger question was, what would I do next? So I turned to God and begged to be given the opportunity to see clearly and know deeply who would parent this baby that I was caring for so well. Finally, just 10 days before I gave birth, I found my baby's parents. A family from my home church knew a family from another church seeking an adoption after a difficult biological pregnancy of their own. I received their binder of photographs and bio, and I instantly knew this family was my baby's family. It was bliss to be at that space of knowing, those doubts and questions for once not blinding my days. We had email exchanges and a phone interview, and this couple was perfect, truly. They were Mennonite, they had careers they enjoyed, they had a church family who loved them, they were sweet parents to their little daughter. They were fit and smart and loving. It was as though I was meant to carry their baby. God has a powerful way of making things clear. The big event was coming, the big hello, the big goodbye. Jennifer and my brother-in-law, Kent, and I went to the hospital at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Days after the birth, my midwife said I'd looked scared when I arrived at the hospital. I was absolutely frightened. Here I was, about to finally meet this child I'd been carrying. It would become this animated being that I'd have to hold once and let go forever. 3 hours after we arrived, I pushed out this little person and everyone stood still, their breath held, looking at me expectantly. And I said, "Oh, it's a girl." I met my daughter. Then I called her parents and said, "I gave birth to your daughter, but I don't know her name." "Sophia," they said. "Sophia Grace, we're on our way." While pregnant, I had planned a giving ceremony for my baby. I went to 10,000 villages in search of the perfect basket in which to place the baby during the ceremony that would then be handed over to her parents with all the notes and letters I'd been writing to the baby. I was picking up all sorts of baskets, trying to figure if they'd hold a baby or not, testing them gently. A woman came up to me and said, "You must be so excited to have your baby." And I said to her, "Actually, I'm not excited. I'm placing this baby for adoption." I could tell she was horrified, though I wasn't sure if it was because of what she said or what I said, but she replied weakly, "Oh my, I've never known anyone that gave up her baby." And then she touched my arm. And maybe it was because I hadn't been touched during my pregnancy, or I was frustrated with the basket, or it was so hot, or I was so big, or I was making such a shattering decision, but I recoiled from her touch and said, "You don't know me." It just shot from my mouth. Maybe because that was what this baby had been echoing into my body those 9 months. "You don't know me. You don't know me. You don't know me." I didn't want to know. I pushed the tiny heels that tried to punch through my stomach. I didn't think of names. I didn't buy anything baby related. But there she was in the hospital, Sophia Grace, beautiful and perfect. I took more than 75 pictures of her first day of life. There's something breathtaking about meeting someone you know you are leaving, someone you will say goodbye to when only days old. I studied her. I tried to see myself in her face. I wondered if she looked like her Mexican birth father. I marveled at the wonder of her. She was so healthy and so delicious, like a little almond. My brother-in-law, Kent, had to leave soon after the birth to tend to his farming operation. When he returned to the hospital that afternoon, the creases in his hands black from harvesting tomatoes, he presented to me three very critical distinctions about how I could approach my final choice, and he read them to me where he had written them on a seed packet. "Claire," he said, "you have very few guarantees in this life, and especially in this decision about whether to place your baby for adoption or not. If you place your baby for adoption, you might get back together with John, and you might not. You might lose John. There's no guarantee. If you keep your baby, you might get back together with John, and you might not. You might lose John. There's no guarantee. The only guarantee is that if you place your baby for adoption, you lose your baby." When my due date was starting to creep closer, the bi-monthly visits from John stopped, since he had decided to explore Europe on a spiritual journey with the express desire to give me space to make my final decision. While traveling, he checked his email at an internet cafe, getting word from Kent that I had given birth to a girl. With that news, he tracked down a phone in Spain and called my hospital room in the deep of the night. We cried. And we shared tidbits of our latest adventures, mine, birth, his, missing luggage. He said he loved me no matter what. He said he was proud of me and he missed me. He said he prayed for me every day and seemed to see pregnant women and babies everywhere he looked. And in Spain, they all looked like me. I told him Sophia was always crying and unsatisfied with the formula, spitting out angry, staining milk on everything. He said he had to go. His money was almost used up. He told me to go down to the nursery and bring Sophia back to my room and take more pictures. So I did. And then she was content to just sleep in my arms. I hadn't slept because I knew I had only a few short days with my baby before I would become her birth mother and she would become the daughter to another. Sophia's parents arrived in town. They wanted to come meet their daughter as soon as possible, but I wasn't ready to meet them. I needed something. I needed air, space, time, certainty. I thought about Kent's words that had come to him in the middle of the loamy, rich earth of an organic vegetable garden. I mostly just sat in my bed for a day and sobbed. I pinched my eyes, hoping all of this life would disappear. I screamed, my heart breaking, and then something stopped my crying. Something scary, which I know now was the quiet understanding of God's wonder. That I was God's birth child cared for by my parents. I was safe, and Sophia would be safe no matter what. So I made my choice, and I knew what I had to do. I had to tell Sophia. I got her from the nursery and propped her up on my bed and told her many things, private things. But most significantly, I told her I was sorry. I was so, so sorry. I didn't know how to explain to her that I loved her, but the letters I wrote to her while I was pregnant with her would be understood when she read them when she was older. It was the early, early morning on the day of the giving ceremony when I was talking to Sophia. My parents were soon to arrive to stand beside me, their baby, as I placed my baby in the arms of her new parents. The sun was just peeking into the room. So I left Sophia on the bed where we'd had our serious conversation and I set up my camera and tripod. I looked at her on the bed as I paused, my finger over the timer button on my camera, shaking but certain. I'd made my choice. I pressed the timer, picked her up for one last time as Sophia sat in the rocking chair, whispered her new name, Gloria, into her ear and gave her my breast. The shutter released. Flash, a mother and daughter meeting for the first time. I cried into the dark hair of my wonder, my daughter. I felt her tiny body heave a huge sigh of relief while she loaded up on the breast milk she'd been screaming for 2 long days and nights. We nursed and nursed, and there is something lovely and stunning about having that hour together on earth, knowing she was my daughter and I was her mama, and no one else knew, just the two of us. When my parents arrived for the giving ceremony, I was back in my hospital bed holding Gloria. And they came with loving but sad faces and a bouquet of flowers from their garden. I let them see us sitting there. And then I said in a small voice, "Mom and Dad, I want you to meet my daughter, Gloria." And they knew in an instant and cried out with joy. They kissed me and they kissed her new granddaughter and said they loved me no matter what. I heard it finally like a deep plate shifting in my inner being. "I love you no matter what." John had said it. My parents had said it. So many others had all but said it during my pregnancy because God was breathing into that time, reminding me of this promise to all of us. "I will love you no matter what." While my parents and I quietly celebrated this change of plans, I knew there would be no similar joy when the adoptive parents got the news. I brought my baby home to the basement of the church, reeling with the realization that I had not one single thing for a baby. No diapers, no clothes, no blankets, no toys, nothing. Then my sister said, "We have to go meet the adoptive parents right now." So I left Gloria with her grandparents and went to meet the adoptive parents for the first and last time. They were absolutely heartbroken. They had the familiar tear-streaked faces I had been wearing for 2 days. We sat on couches facing each other. It was August. It was hot. My body felt weird and exhausted from lack of sleep and birth. My milk was coming and leaking down my tank top. They asked if I had changed my mind because of John. Had he said he would get back together with me? No. In fact, he let me go, I said. They asked if I had changed my mind because of anything about them, something I didn't like. No. In fact, I was so blessed to have them as a part of my life story because without them, I would not have been able to fully choose my daughter, truly choosing to mother my own child when a wonderful option was available. And they said something I'll always remember. "Claire," they said, "we want what is best for that baby. If that is for you to be her mother, that is what we want." And then we parted. The abundance became clear after that meeting. Choosing Gloria spurred great desire in me to create a life for the two of us that I could love. I finished my master's because of Gloria. I slowed down because of her. I paid attention. Abundance. John traveled to be present at Gloria's dedication when she was 6 months old. Abundance. I discovered a year after Gloria was born that the adoptive parents did in fact adopt a child, born on the exact same morning Gloria was born, just in another country. So their baby was born that day after all. Abundance. The last time John and I spoke, he let me know he had presented his family tree to his master's program class for marriage and family therapy. And someone had asked him why he included Gloria in his family tree, arguing she wasn't his child. And he told them, "She is a part of my life story, part of my family. I'm keeping Gloria on my family tree." Abundance. Years later, when my sister was searching for a new pastorate, she was offered a position at a church. But before she accepted, she called me and said, "Claire, the church wanting to hire me is attended by the adoptive parents. If you don't want me to take the job because of that, I won't." Without hesitation, I said to absolutely take it because they are an integral part of my story and the story of Gloria. Abundance. I did eventually see the adoptive parents again. It was Mother's Day Sunday. As the adoptive mom gave me a hug, I whispered to her, "I get to celebrate today because of you. Thank you." Love is an option among many. Choose love. It is the path to abundance.
I love your story. It is powerful precisely because you tell it completely. You name realities that we don't often talk about. Betrayal, naivete, marrying young. What compelled you to start there, to go there? You could have simply begun, I found myself pregnant at 22. Lots of people do it that way.
That is a question. This is my life's story. I didn't realize it when I was in it, but those activities, those choices, those moments, they were creating my life's story. And I think of a life story as one that gives you an opportunity to choose powerfully. I don't think of a life story as meant to define you. If that were the case, my reflection on that season of my life would be, I'm a cheater. Not only is that blunt and heartless, but it shows, in my opinion, a lack of deep thinking. And I know it's popular to talk about a defining moment in one's life, but that can be such a destructive way to make meaning out of events and emotions, let alone it's super uncreative and, in my opinion, spiritless. It feels boxed into me to talk about defining moments. Instead of thinking of that time as a defining moment, I think of it as my life story. A story can change. It happens all the time. You're thinking about a story, the characters, the words, the weather can change over time. Even the exact same stories I heard about Jesus as a little girl have shifted over time, like my understanding, their ultimate meanings, the history, the context, the language. I mean, goodness, the Gospels have like tiny differences among their shared stories. And that never frustrates me. It always compels me to love my God even more fiercely because of entrusting these very human writers to take on the love story with their individual gifts of storytelling. So for me, I feel there's a difference between defining moments and life stories. When I talk about hard things like adultery and betrayal, I feel it actually lessens the weight of those words and their power over me. All of my time having an affair was all about keeping quiet, shrouding, protecting, lying. Frankly, it's super exhausting, you know? When you are in the darkness of your own making, all you want to do is to step into the light, truly. Like, that was my reality. Darkness was just eating away at me, and I felt trapped and scared and all of that. And when I take care of my side of the street and my participation in, like, creating those dark spaces when I was in Alaska, my deepest part, like the deepest part of my soul, wanted the light of like revelation even more than maintaining the lie. So words have that same effect on me. They can trap me if I don't face them. So bringing them into the light, like with this story and talking about it here live, exposes them to love and wonder instead of giving them all the power of being hidden.
And I also think about how we often think so negatively of the darkness. And in the darkness, oftentimes is where new things begin, you know?
Well, yeah, that's when the human body's cells restore at night in darkness. Mm-hmm. That's the only time we get to see stars. Living through a dark night of the soul is so hard and so worth it. This experience of realizing my life story, it reminds me almost daily that I don't know everybody's story. Everybody is either they've had one, they're living one, or they're living into one. So it gives me lots more compassion for how people are behaving. I don't know what's going on for people, what they've lived through. And everyone has one, which is like an amazing way our humanity is connected.
You frame this essay in the context of love. It's so clear how each participant in your story, from your professor, you know, to the adoptive parents, to your family, and then in the end, you say you make your choice in love. And I think we often talk about love as something we feel, it's a feeling, mm-hmm. But you see love differently. What's the difference between this feeling we have and the choice you describe?
I love this question. Love, the feeling, is like a vase of cut flowers. Let's be real, they're dead. Love, the choice, is a garden of perennials. So you've selected your flowers, planted them, split them up, overwintered them, covered them with sheets during the first frost, let the weeds take over in a small patch, drowned another area with too much water, didn't dehead them for a week. All of those actions are like little choices. Just like in my story, all of these little choices created one big, beautiful life story that I can tend to while my garden gets additions of new flowers each season, right? So I think and like connect the best with metaphor. So for me, I just see love as a feeling like, yeah, cut flowers. They're dead. And they look beautiful for a little bit and then you throw them in the garbage. And love as like a choice is like a garden of perennials.
That's a beautiful metaphor. It is. Because it's not always perfect.
So we make mistakes. We neglect things. There's pests. There's drought. There's weather. And then there's like amazing lily of the valley. For me, that's how I connect the most with thinking about love as a choice. It's work.
As I listened back through this conversation, I thought about the pain, the hopelessness, and the loss that I've experienced in my life. We all inevitably encounter heartbreak. Whether the pain was the result of a choice we made, or the simple fact that we are in relationship with other imperfect people across the span of our lives, we all, if we've lived long enough, understand brokenness and disappointment, lack of clarity, feeling undone. There is power, though, I believe, in wrestling with, in integrating the stories of darkness into our life stories. I truly believe that like seeds waiting to break open, buried beneath dark soil, magic happens in the dark places of our lives. And as we courageously face those dark places, honestly, authentically, we heal. We become more whole. The poet Nayira Wahid writes, "We have all hurt someone tremendously, whether by intent or accident. We have all loved someone tremendously, whether by intent or accident. It is an intrinsic human trait and a deep responsibility, I think, to be an organ and a blade. But learning to forgive ourselves and others because we have not chosen wisely is what makes us most human. We make horrible mistakes. It's how we learn. We breathe love. It's how we learn. And it is inevitable." Thanks, Claire, for challenging us to embrace our wholeness, to name hard things, and to live into our life story. What do you wish people talked more about? What conversations have you been yearning to have? Send me a voice memo at jennifer.c@mennoniteusa.org and tell me about your subject. Why is it so hard to talk about? Why do we need to be talking about it? Perhaps you'll be featured on our Breaking Silences Talkback episode. This episode was produced by me, Jenny Castro, with editing help from Shay Langley. Our theme music was written and recorded by the very talented Addy Lichty. To find more music by Addy, look for Addy in the Subtracts on Facebook or Addy Lichty on YouTube. Holding It Together is a joint production of Mennonite Church USA's Office of Women in Leadership and the Mennonite Inc. Look for us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Fireside, or wherever you prefer. If you have a second, I'd invite you to rate and review us. And please share the podcast with your friends. I'm your host, Jenny Castro. Thanks for listening, y'all. Talk soon.